Hey, folks, welcome to the show. My guest this week, someone that I really admired and my wife does as well, a big fan of his. He is an award-winning journalist, a practicing neurosurgeon who you've seen on CNN for many, many years, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thanks for having me, and thank your wife as well.
Yeah, you've got a new series out, Chasing Life, which we've been watching, and it's really terrific. And you visited six countries and really found, you know, Japan, India, Bolivia, Norway, Italy, and Turkey, and really discovered some fascinating stuff. What motivated you to do the series?
Well, you know, there's clearly a motivation to just do a show that can really teach people about health in a different way through stories, through actually going to these places. But I think there was a level deeper for me, which is, you know, I'm an American doctor. I practice medicine in this system as a neurosurgeon. And I will be, you know, I'll tell you, like a lot of my colleagues, that look, we spend $3.5 trillion on healthcare every year, far more than even the next, you know, biggest spender. And despite that, our life expectancy in the United States has gone down 3 years in a row. It's a really staggering thing. I mean, we don't have enough time to get into it, but it's almost existential in terms of what that means. Birth rate is going down and life expectancy is going down in the United States. But to the question, though, is there's obviously other countries around the world where their life expectancy continues to go up. And on some, they are living happier, healthier, longer lives, better in all metrics as compared to the United States. Mm-hmm. So what are they doing? What can we learn? I wanted to go there and find those things, prove them if they were true or not, and bring those stories back home.
Were there any preconceived notions that you went in with that were debunked and or confirmed in heading into this endeavor?
Well, when you're planning these types of shows and, you know, there's huge crews and everybody is sort of, you know, got some idea of what we're going for. So we had basic knowledge of these places, but we did not have preconceived notions about what we were going to find. So, for example, I spent some time living with the Chimane indigenous tribe in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. That was one of our shows, Bolivia. And the reason that I did that was because there had been these studies that had basically showed that they had the healthiest hearts in the world. They basically had little, if any, evidence of heart disease. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And those were good studies that showed that. We knew that part of it, but what we didn't know in terms of preconceived notions is exactly why. So we got to go there and actually live that life of the Chimane to try and understand something that we ultimately found pretty surprising.
And what did you find? What was the discovery?
Yeah, I was taking a guess. That is the next logical question, right? So what was it?
What you should have said was, hey, if you want to know, you got to tune in. That's what you got.
Right, I know. I'll tell you, because it was really fascinating to me. You focus on the big three things, which are diet, activity, rest. And I will cut to the chase by telling you they do a really good job with all those things. That's not surprising. I mean, they don't have access to processed foods. You know, they're a hunter-gatherer society, so they're obviously active, although not intensely active. They have hardly any, you know, the most mechanical thing I saw there was the pulley for the well. So they're not staring at devices all day. You know, all those things are true. But here's the thing that was surprising. They almost all live with some degree of chronic parasite infection, which that caused you to pause and saying, well, you know, what's that have to do with anything? Well, the reality is that, first of all, most of our human existence, we lived with parasites. We co-evolved with them. We didn't have medication to treat them. And if you drank water out of the rivers, lakes, you probably would get a parasitic infection. It was just how humans evolved. Now we treat that obviously very aggressively in the developed world. And the point is this, Paul, that maybe we were supposed to have some sort of coevolution with an organism like a parasite. That's how the human body evolved, and that's how our immune systems evolved. And so our immune systems, instead, living in these self-imposed hygienic bubbles, tend to increasingly focus their attention inward, the coronary vessels leading to the heart, you know, the blood vessels leading to the brain, causing inflammation in the form of autoimmune diseases, whatever it might be. That could be a bored immune system that is supposed to have this parasite modulator in the body. Anyways, long answer, I realize, but that I did not expect. And I thought it was really interesting that you know, our own immune systems could be the cause of these diseases. If we just buffer it, we maybe can help avoid a lot of these diseases.
Well, I mean, you know, to kind of sort of bring it to what we're dealing with right now in America, and the issue of measles, and, you know, some people feel expose the kids to measles, don't use vaccines. Does what you discovered and you just described support that idea of at least some exposure to it could actually help build a resistance to it, or is it much or more complicated than that?
No, I would not advocate that exposure to it. I mean, we have a vaccine to this, and you can get really sick with measles, even be hospitalized or even die from it. Mm. So that none of this, what I learned, is to say that we should not take advantage of things that we know work, have been the gold standard, have all this evidence behind it. So even with the parasites in Bolivia, I wouldn't say that, I'm not encouraging anybody to go out and get a parasitic infection, because you will get sick
from
that.
Right.
In Bolivia, they didn't have a choice in the Amazon rainforest. But my point is this, there's a lesson in there. Mm-hmm. So is there a way, much as we've looked at the microbiome, if I told you 20 years ago that you have more bacteria in your body, Paul, than human cells, might have freaked you out a little bit. And now we know it's true. We nurture and foster the microbiome in the pursuit of good health. Is there a lesson in there with regard to the parasites as well, in terms of how we treat our immune system? So yes, absolutely get the measles vaccine.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. But with regard to parasites, I think there's going to be some really interesting science that goes forth that can help us all.
In terms of practical application, what happens in the real world, how much are countries talking to each other regarding world health to sort of help each other? We don't live in a vacuum, obviously, but, you know, America can be, you know, very focused on itself. Is there a lot of crosstalk and conversation and sort of, you know, trading of ideas and so forth among countries? And has it borne fruit here in America for us in any way?
I think a lot of that cross-pollination and cross-discussion around these topics take place at the academic setting, you know, in terms of shared knowledge, whether it be diabetes or heart disease. I think there's like big spikes in that sort of collaboration around things like H1N1, you know, a flu virus that is starting to circulate, because I think there's a recognition that that's something that could affect, you know, humanity. And so there needs to be some cross discussion. I think you're seeing like really specific efforts with regard to polio, and it is possible that we could eradicate polio from the world. The last three places where it exists really is Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. And so, you know, there's a U.S.-based efforts as well as African efforts that are collaborating to try and, you know, rid the world of polio. So you see it in those types of things. But for the most part, I think, you know, like there is the New England Journal of Medicine. There's the Journal of the American Medical Association, the American Heart Association Journal. It gets very provincial, I think, sometimes with regard to medical knowledge.
Right. You know, the great thing about this series is that you also kind of went on an emotional health journey, if you will, as well, you know, which I, you know, obviously is very important. And there's an interesting quote of yours that I read. You said, "I traveled to a Norwegian city 270 miles north of the Arctic Circle that, despite being dark for much of the year, was filled with happy people. That showed me something about the relationship between environment and happiness." I was surprised to hear that. Expand on that a little bit. That's really fascinating to me.
Well, yeah. I think that, you know, that was sort of became the question right off the bat is, okay, we know the data here. This Norway consistently ranks among the happiest countries in the world. We know what the environment's like, especially in northern Norway. So are people happy despite the environment, or are they happy because of the environment? That was sort of the basic question. And that was as far as we sort of were asking the question. We didn't want to walk in with preconceived notions. But I will tell you, like, what I gathered and talking to the academic community, but also just talking to lots of people, is that how you define happiness is a big part of this. If you overcome some sort of challenge on a regular basis, you overcome that challenge, and at the end of the day, you say, "I overcame this challenge." The capacity that provides for happiness seems to be much greater than if you just lived on a beach every day and life was great, but it was the same. There was nothing particularly challenging. Mm. So would you rather have these exquisite moments of happiness in the wake of having achieved something that you thought was challenging and difficult? Or would you rather have a good level of happiness, but sort of flat in terms of the curve? You know, it doesn't really have these spikes, ups and downs. And I think we all have ebbs and flows of happiness, but would you want to live in a place where you have the capacity to have the super high peaks? That's what I think we found in Norway.
So it is peaks and valleys in Norway.
Yeah, it is peaks and valleys. I think within a month, within a week, within a day, we all have peaks and valleys when it comes to happiness. Mm-hmm. But I think if in part you measure the happiness by how high was the high, you know,
right.
How good did it get?
Right.
That was what we seem to see in Norway.
Do you think?
And I think that from a personal standpoint, that's how I am as well. I know I'm not going to be happy all the time necessarily, or exquisitely happy all the time, but I'd love to have those moments.
Yeah, I mean, it's also probably, if I'm not mistaken, Norway's like a socialized democracy like Denmark, and my brother-in-law lives in Denmark, and it's a very huge, essentially middle class, very few rich, very few poor. So that I feel whenever I visit there, it's not the culture of America. And not that this is bad in America, but like there's such a drive for capitalism and bigger and better and more. And I feel like, you know, and I find myself running races with myself and other people and why isn't my car bigger and all of that. And I feel like on some level that contributes to people's mood about themselves, depression, happiness. And if you live in a country where that's less of a priority, maybe that allows them a better chance to be more consistently happy.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Paul. And you know, when I was talking about happiness, you know, of the Norwegian people from the environment, I was talking about the surprise that the people could be that happy in the environment. But I think in terms of what's really driving it, I think you're right. I mean, it's fourth largest oil exporter. It's a very wealthy country. They have socialized healthcare, so everyone has healthcare, and there is a low what they call Gini coefficient, which means a low income inequality sort of that exists in Norway, to your point. There was this fascinating experiment that we showed in this HBO film recently where you had two capuchin monkeys right next to each other in these cages, and they do a task and they get a cucumber. Cucumber is a desirable treat. They do this 25 times in a row, and then at some point we start giving the monkey on the right a grape, a more desirable treat. And what do you think happens? Monkey on the left that's not getting the grape gets really pissed off, literally rattling the cage.
Really?
I'm perfectly happy with the cucumber 25 times in a row. But now that I've seen this gross inequality that seems unfair and it's blatant, it makes him really upset. But you know the other thing, the surprising thing, that maybe you'd expect, the surprising thing was the monkey that was getting the grape, stress levels also shot through the roof. So it seems, if you look at it from a biological standpoint, no matter where you are on the spectrum, rich or poor, have or have not, if you live in a place that is full of glaring income inequality, that feels unstable, that feels stressed, and I think leads to lower levels of happiness.
We'll be back with our conversation with Sanjay Gupta in just a second. Look, I want to talk to you about one of my sponsors. Okay, sponsors help me bring you the show, so I appreciate you considering giving them your business. Let's be honest. Losing hair sucks. I know. I just grew hair on my knuckles. I don't know how that happened. And yet I'm losing hair on my head. I'm like an ape in reverse. And 2 out of 3 guys will experience hair loss by the time they're 35. Well, introducing Keeps. It's the easiest and most affordable way to keep the hair you have. These FDA-approved products used to cost so much. But now, thanks to Keeps, they're inexpensive and easy to get. For 5 minutes now and starting at just $10 a month, you'll never have to worry about hair loss again. Getting started with Keeps is really easy. I did it. Signed up, took less than 5 minutes, just answered a few questions, you snap some photos of your hair, boom. A licensed physician will review your information online, recommend the right treatment for you, then it's shipped to your door every 3 months. Keeps offers generic versions of the only 2 FDA-approved hair loss products out there. Some of you probably tried them before, but you've never gotten them for this price. Keeps is only $10 to $35 a month. Think about it. You can retire that toupee that looks like roadkill. I can stop wearing hats all the time. I'm wearing hats to bed. My wife's not a fan. I took her eye out with a brim. By the way, now you can get your first month free. A good deal to keep your hair. So to receive your first month of treatment free, go to keeps.com/Paul. That's KEEPS.com/Paul. That's a free month of treatment at keeps.com/Paul. Keeps, hair today, hair tomorrow. In Japan, in the episode about Japan, you did forest bathing. Can you describe what that is?
Forest bathing is, first of all, you don't get wet. That's the first thing. You're bathing yourself in the aroma of the forest, if you will. And it's you know, I mean, there's all sorts of different ways people would describe it, nature walks, things like that. But the reason we talked about it as much as we did was, first of all, Japan's one of the most stressed countries in the world. And when you live in a country that's that stressed, part of the evolution is that you start to come up with all these different strategies to try and alleviate that stress. You know, we think about yoga and meditation, and, you know, they have rage rooms and owl cafes and cat cafes and all these different sort of cottage industries that have sprouted up to try and provide strategies for people to relieve stress. Forest bathing is one of them, where you just go out and you spend real time in nature. The thing that was fascinating to me was that what we learned is that, you know, when you're outside and you breathe in the aroma of the forest, that smell, you know what I'm talking about, it's that smell is filled with chemicals known as phytoncides. Phytoncides are natural chemicals that are emitted from nature, from trees and plants and shrubs, that are stress-busting chemicals. They protect those organisms from stress. Turns out we have receptors for those in our body as well. So when you breathe in the aroma of the forest, you're breathing in a known substance that evolutionarily has always reduced our stress, and as it does for nature. And so I find it interesting that there's a real scientific underpinning as to why I feel so good.
Yeah, because as a layperson, you know, you hear, you know, my friend, he went camping, he said it relaxes him, and I would just assume it's because he hears a brook running and he's, you know, birds are chirping and the sort of those traditional senses. But yeah, that's an interesting takeaway. I'm really fascinated. That's really interesting. In India, you said that there's a seamless connection between like health and happiness, which seemed kind of on the surface obvious, but it's actually deeper than that. Can you describe that a little bit to me? Because I think it also affected how you sort of inspire people to be happy, you said. Healthy, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that health, when you just say the word health in a place like the United States, it feels like we're talking about some sort of necessary evil, mm-hmm. right? You must exercise, you must eat your broccoli, whatever it might be. But there's been sort of this disentangling between being healthy and feeling good. Right. It feels like something that you're required to do is something that actually will make you feel better. And that's in part what the seamless nature of it is. It's a closed loop in some ways. The idea that if you do these things, it's not that you're going to prevent a disease 40 years from now. It's that you're going to be better. You're going to be a better son, better daughter, better wife, better husband, better friend, better coworker. You're going to be more productive. You're going to be more joyous. You're going to be happier, healthier, all those things now. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what really came across in India, was that this isn't about some necessary thing they have to do to so that they, the obligation so as to not develop heart disease 40 years from now. This is so that I'll be better in the next hour, the mm-hmm. next day, you know, mm-hmm. and I thought that was the seamless nature of it.
Yeah, this is all so interesting. I could talk to you all day about this, Sanjay. One thing that I noticed, you sort of, I remember watching you early on when you were on CNN and, excuse me, and you were, you know, a healthy looking guy, but then you seemed to go on a health kick. Maybe that's not the right term. You were running a lot. You lost weight. Not that you were ever heavy or anything, but, was there something that happened in your life that made you more conscious of that? Cause I remember seeing a bit of a transformation in you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's interesting. I think there were a few things. First of all, just I think in an ironic way, going through medical training and, you know, for neurosurgery, you know, you do 4 years of med school and then 7 years of residency. And then I did a year of fellowship. You know, you're talking 12 years after college. And it's just, you know, some of the schedule, everyone has a tough schedule, but this is particularly challenging up to, 100 hours a week of working. Just it's ironic because you're about to become a practicing physician, and it's very hard to stay healthy as you're training to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. I've always found interesting. So my point is when I had more, some, I was still very busy, but some more control over my schedule. It was always a priority to really to be fit and to exercise. I also have a very strong family history of heart disease. Mm. Father had heart surgery when he was 47. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of feels like the clock was ticking a little bit. And I just want to make sure I did everything I could to be healthy. So those things sort of together, I think, have made eating right, defining what eating right is for me, exercising, defining what exercising right is for me, and then doing it, really important.
Well, glad you did. Need you to stick around for a long time. The series is Chasing Life on CNN and all other platforms that CNN has on the web. And also there's a great piece on Twitter that you have of this gentleman that committed suicide and survived. People should go to your Twitter feed and watch that. It was really inspiring. So you're doing great work. It's great to have you on. Good luck with the series, and hope to have you on again sometime.
Thanks, Paul. And so thanks to your wife again as well. I appreciate you guys watching.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.